I'm going to begin this evening with a little bit of material from 1 Timothy chapter 3, verses 1 to 13. If you want to look at that, this has to do with the marriage requirements for elders. And it bears on the question regarding polygamy and also on divorce and remarriage. Notice that in 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, the first requirement for a leader is that he is the husband of one wife. Now, you can imagine there's been many debates regarding what this means. I want to tell you what the Greek construction is like. And I wish the translators had used this construction because I think it helps clarify the situation. The specific terminology is he must be a one-woman man. That's the terminology. He must be a one-woman man. Now, in Greek, the word gune means either woman or wife, either one. Context determines which it is. Similar to the word Frau in German. Frau means woman or wife, depending on the context. So it's the same kind of thing. And you might make a note of the fact that in 1 Timothy 5, verse 9, where it's talking about the eligibility of widows to be put on the church roll, the exact analogous expression is used, she must be a one-man woman. Now that's useful information because it helps us understand what these things mean because of how they're used. So what are the possible meanings of this one-woman man? He must be a one-woman man. Here's some various meanings that have been proposed. The Catholic Church said that means married to the church, and that was an attempt to promote celibacy. It's pretty obvious that that's not a correct meaning. Some other people have said, well, what this is prohibiting is that polygamists are prohibited from being leaders in the church. He must be a one-woman man. However, there is no evidence whatsoever of polygamists entering the church at this time in history. Polygamy was practically not practiced in the first century in the Roman Empire. It was actually forbidden at that time, even though it was practiced by some. So it was illegal in the Roman world, virtually unknown among the Jews. Herod was despised for his multiple wives. It was theoretically discussed by the rabbis and condemned by Christian authors. So there's no evidence that any polygamist entered the church during the time of the writing of Timothy and Titus. And you know, when people try to say things like, well, this implies there must have been men there with more than one wife, tell them, offer me some proof. In other words, if that's really the case, if it's common that there would be a polygamist in that culture coming into the church, well, then we ought to have some evidence of it. And the burden of proof is on those who make such claims. They make the argument from silence. If they want to make a point, they should find some manuscript that says that at least one polygamist was received into the fellowship in the first century. So if they claim that, ask them to show a citation. Who wrote it and when he wrote it? Now, under that condition, it would be very strange to make the first requirement that he is the one-woman man. Because similarly, just imagine today, what if the requirement was listed for elders today and it said he must not be a Baal worshiper? Well, people in our context aren't worshiping Baal. So that doesn't really seem to fit. The clear refutation of this is the companion requirement for widows in 1 Timothy 5:9. Because you see, if 1 Timothy 3:2 meant a man who was not a polygamist, then in 1 Timothy 5:9, where it's talking about a widow, it would have meant that she has not been involved in polyandry, which would mean she wouldn't have had multiple husbands at one time, and that certainly was not being practiced in either Jewish or pagan circles in that area in the first century. So you see, if this would mean polygamy, then Chapter 5, verse 9 must mean polyandry. That's where a woman has more than one husband. Another suggestion as to what this means is it's prohibiting remarried widowers from being church leaders. Well, it turns out that both pagan and Jewish culture admired those who remained single after their spouse had died. And the same teaching was actually promoted by the church fathers in the early church. So it was thought that ordinary Christians could get married after a spouse's death, but there was a higher standard for leaders. For example, you might notice that in the Old Testament, the high priest could not marry a widow. However, the priestly argument is not valid, because that was for the high priest. Ordinary priests, which would correspond to Christians, were restricted from marrying divorcees. The high priest would correspond to Christ. Besides, this idea conflicts with the New Testament teaching on marriage, which never depicts legitimate second marriage as morally questionable. In fact, legitimate second marriage, if your first spouse has died, does not show any more moral weakness than the first marriage. And again, the refutation of this view conclusively is the parallel with the one-man woman in chapter 5, verse 9, for the widow that's eligible for church support. Clearly, there's no historical reference for this, since she presently has no husband. And of course, Paul would be commanding younger widows to marry, and if they obeyed and were then widowed, then their obedience would forever disqualify them for church support. Chapter 5, 14. So this doesn't seem to fit as a moral requirement for overseers. Well, another idea was that this would be excluding unmarried men. In other words, if you're going to be an elder, you need to be a married man so you can have the kind of experiences that are important and give you some wisdom about family life and so on. But that does not account for the force of the wording one woman man. If it was just going to be that, you wouldn't want to have the term one. In other words, somebody that wasn't married at all. And furthermore, if this were the correct view, then in verse 4, when it talks about children, a man who was married but childless would be disqualified. Also, Paul's admonition that you can serve the Lord in better ways even by being single, if you're doing it because you can do it without distraction, would be seen to be contradicting this. Another view of this one-woman-man idea that the Scripture has is it means having no history of divorce even before conversion. I think that's probably a common view in some circles. The reasons for this view, in this era, many Jews and Romans were divorced, and you would result in marital tangles. That sounds like our day, doesn't it? Remember, God's moral requirements apply not only to the church, but all of society. However, the rebuttal to this view is this. It's impossible to make a requirement extend to pre-conversion days without including the same extension to the other requirements. And if you say, a man, even before he was converted, couldn't have been involved with other women, then you would also have to apply that same kind of criterion to the other cases, like drunkenness. Okay, before he was converted, was he a drunk? Or a fighter, a quarrelsome man? Before he was converted, was he that way? Or somebody who was greedy for money, was he that way before he was converted? Or his household was in chaos, so he's disqualified because it was that way before he was converted. I mean, many men have been drunkards before they were converted. But no one takes the given, not given to much wine as meaning they shouldn't be elders if they got converted and got cleaned up and haven't bothered it since. And so I think a better understanding is by taking the Greek text literally, even if it makes an awkward statement in English. And that is, he must be a one-woman man. The emphasis here is on his character. Now notice the qualifications that he gives to these elders is qualifications that God expects for all believers. Not being quarrelsome, being a one-woman man, not being a drunk, and so on. There's no indication that inappropriately married brothers are in the fellowship or the congregation, and the requirement of not being given too much wine does not mean it's fine for the rest of the congregation to be a bunch of drunks. God expects elders to be leaders. Leaders in personal spiritual attainment, exemplary in their lives for others to follow. So in selecting an elder, you are looking for someone who's victorious, not someone who's struggling in these areas. And so the key is repentance of past sins and present abstinence from sin and entanglements. Now, who would be disqualified by the one-woman-man limitation? First of all, the man who is flirtatious. You know, you've seen men, haven't you, that are flirts? They like to flirt with the ladies. They love to talk to the ladies in the fellowship. And maybe to encourage the lady, they'll put their hand on her shoulder. You know what? I don't think that's the guy you want for an elder. Or a man who's struggling with pornography. You know, such a man is not content with his wife. Those with additional responsibility regarding past marriages. For example, a man who was a polygamist and put away wives he had no right to, but then needing to support all those different women, would have entanglements that would mean he would not be a one-woman man, even though he is living righteously because he has to connect to all those different women. A man with a history of divorce. You see, if he had a history of divorce, doesn't mean that he's not living right now, but maybe has to be paying alimony and child custody interactions and nurturing children from the past marriages at a distance. And those kind of responsibilities would distract a man from ministry. And they would bring conflict into his present situation. And they require that he have detailed and repeated interaction with a woman not God joined to himself at the present. So what I'm saying is that kind of person is not a one-woman man. Who would qualify? I believe it's a man who is married only in a God-joined marriage and faithful to her and trustworthy. This is ideal because that eliminates the reproach of an ex-wife, complications with children, and it enables him to teach clearly God's standard for marriage. It would also be a man, another case would be a man who separated from all unholy relationships, divorce in his past, and has solid experience in moral faithfulness. He's not a ladies' man. He's not having tangles mentioned above. But there's a little warning here. In my mind, leadership and counseling in the church may open him to intense moral temptation. Might not be wise to consider as an elder. So you see, in summary, disqualified by two basic areas, struggles regarding moral purity or entanglements from the past that require repeated involvement with one or more women. Now, that's background because that kind of question comes up in relation to polygamy because it talks about husband of one wife, and that's why we went through some of that since we hadn't gone through that earlier. Now, let's go to the section where we're going to address polygamy more specifically. You might ask, well, why do we have a session on polygamy? It is because polygamy is part of the biblical material on marriage. And understanding polygamy helps us to understand marriage. Polygamy is an aberrant form of marriage. In other words, it's a form of marriage where a man is married to more than one woman at a time. And by the way, polygamy is not just in Africa. It is not just in Utah with the Mormons. It's in Canada too. I was talking to a pastor a few years ago. I believe it was, I forget which year it was right now. But he told me that he had a convert and here this guy was a polygamist. What was he going to do about it? So let's begin by affirming what we agree on from what we've studied so far. God's standard for marriage is joining of one man and one woman. In the New Testament era, which is where we are, remarriage after divorce is adultery. Furthermore, when you study the whole Bible and when you observe the practices in the world of polygamy, you find that polygamy is a great evil, as evidenced both by Scripture and observation of what happens when people do it. Now, the only question that's left is, should existing polygamy be allowed to continue for believers? Let's suppose you're on a mission program and you're working with a group of people that practice polygamy, and someone is converted and he has three wives. Should he be allowed to come into full fellowship in the church and continue to live with all three of those wives? So that means we need to study what the Bible has to say about polygamy and apply our understanding of marriage in addition to that material. First of all, in the Old Testament, polygamy was not counted as adultery. Believers were not censured for being polygamists in terms of that they shouldn't do that. Jacob was never censured as an adulterer, even though he had four wives, Leah, Rachel, and then two lower class wives. God did make a rebuke on Jacob. He closed Rachel's womb, Genesis 29, verse 31, because Jacob hated Leah. In other words, it wasn't specifically because he was married to a second wife, but because he hated the first one. And then Genesis 30, verse 22, later God opened Rachel's womb in relation to prayer. Incidentally, the blessing on Ruth mentions Rachel in addition to Leah in Ruth 4:11. That would be sort of strange if the relationship to Rachel was adultery. And incidentally also, an illegitimate child could not enter the congregation of the Lord to the 10th generation. If these would have been not valid marriages in the Old Testament context, half of Jacob's sons would have been illegitimate. Furthermore, David was never censured for polygamy, but he was severely judged for his adultery. So what I'm trying to say is, when you read the Old Testament, it is clear that polygamy was permitted for believers. Also, the legal requirements of the Mosaic Law accepted polygamy. Polygamy is notably absent from the sexual sin lists in the Old Testament. For example, in Leviticus chapter 18 and chapter 20, you have listing of adultery, homosexuality, incest, and bestiality, and none of those, all of those are mentioned, but polygamy is not mentioned. And there were punishments for adultery and harlotry, but not polygamy. For example, adulterers were to be executed. You can read about that in Leviticus 20, verse 10. Stoning was specified in Deuteronomy 22, verse 23 and 24. And the priest who had a daughter who profaned her father by harlotry was to be burnt by fire, Leviticus 21, 9. And God also regulated the practice of polygamy. He didn't allow the husband to bypass the actual firstborn because he wanted to give his material goods to the child of his favorite wife. If the firstborn was for his unfavorite wife, he had to give his fair share to the firstborn of the unfavorite wife. You can read about that in Deuteronomy 21. And then, interestingly enough, if a man was married in the Old Testament, affairs with single girls, like non-betrothed girls, did not account as adultery. A man who seduced a virgin was required to marry her, and that requirement certainly was not limited to just single men. You can read about that in Deuteronomy 22, verse 28 and 29. And then furthermore, God's command for what is called Levirate marriage, where a brother takes his brother's widow as wife, was not counted as adultery. And by the way, you can read about that in Deuteronomy 25, verse 5 and 6. And the command probably had in view an unmarried brother living with his married brother. The reason I say that is because it begins by saying, if brethren dwell together. And you see, that would be much more likely if the one brother was married and a younger brother was dwelling there with him, and then the older brother died, then he's to take this other woman. And that would also fit then with God's plan for one man and one woman. In other words, there's no specific evidence that says a man that I know of, that says that a man that already had a wife was supposed to do the Levirate marriage. Now, here's some examples of Levirate marriage in the Old Testament, and we never have a case where it is specifically polygamy. For example, Judah's youngest son, for whom Tamar was waiting, was not married. And this also fits with the wording of the Sadducees' trick question in Matthew 22 when they ask about this woman who had a husband and then he died childless, and so the next brother married her and he died childless, the next brother married, so they all seven had her. The terminology fits the oldest going to the youngest, and the younger ones were less likely to be married, of course. Now, you cannot conclusively claim that levirate marriage demanded polygamy. See, some people want to automatically assume that. But even if it did, polygamy was not counted as adultery in the Old Testament. Now notice the self-consistency in the Old Testament. Multiple partners were permitted for men. Polygamy was not counted as adultery. Having concubines was not counted as adultery. Remarriage after divorce was not counted as adultery. And even the seduction of single girls was not counted as adultery. The man had to marry a woman he seduced. Now, how does the New Testament change the believer's view of polygamy? Well, Jesus' teaching in the Gospels expands the definition of adultery because he says remarriage after divorce is adultery. That was not how it was in the Old Testament. And he also said a man could commit adultery against his own wife. That was unheard of in the Old Testament. A man committed adultery by taking someone else's wife. That was the idea in the Old Testament. And Jesus was revolutionary in his day in what he said, that a man could commit adultery against his own wife. 1 Corinthians 7, verses 1 to 15. If you forgot what that is, you can glance at it. Paul's commands are impossible for a polygamist to fulfill. Verse 2, each person is to have their own spouse. And you see, if a man has two wives, each wife would not have her own husband, exclusively hers. Furthermore, verse 3, there's the obligation to render affection due to your spouse. 1 Corinthians 7, verse 3. A man who takes a second wife automatically separates himself from the first one in forming the new union. And then there's this, sometimes with one, sometimes with another. So he cannot be giving his full affection to either one. Verse 4, there's a mutual obligation to give the spouse complete control of your body. The husband has control of the wife's body, and the wife has control of the husband's body. And that is ruined when you have a polygamist, because no wife of a polygamist has control of her husband's body. Clearly, a polygamist ceases to give his first wife authority over his body when he marries a second wife, and as long as he continues with a second wife. You see, it's not just that he married her, but as long as he's continuing with her, he cannot fulfill 1 Corinthians 7. That's a serious problem. Furthermore, in the New Testament usages of singular and plural regarding spouses, sometimes it speaks of husbands, plural, and wives, plural, but it's talking about a group of men who are individually married. It's not talking about one man who has a group of wives or one woman who has a group of husbands. Whenever husband, singular, it is always wife, singular. So we have to understand the contrast between the Old Testament and the New Testament. You see, there were sins regarding a second wife in the New Testament. The act of taking a second wife, that's refusing Jesus' standard of taking man back to creation and God's intention of having only one woman for one man. If you take a second wife, you are going directly against God's standard that Jesus emphasized. Looking on another and desiring her. I mean, before you take that second wife, you've got to look at this woman and say, you know what, that's one I'd like. Not loving your wife as yourself. Would you like your wife to take a second husband? Most husbands would not like that idea. You're not loving your present wife as Christ loved the church. It's a bad testimony to unbelievers. And by the way, taking a second wife mars the symbolism of Christ in the church. And it will inevitably bring rivalry and disharmony into the home. No question about it. If you have questions about it, go back and read about Jacob and his wives, Leah and Rachel, and all the deals they're trying to make. And you can read about it in the sociological literature, if you like. You know, it's common knowledge that if a man has two wives, there's strife in the home. And you can see it disqualifies a man to be a leader in the church because he wouldn't be a one-woman man. The state of continuing with a second wife, it would continue to mar the Christ church symbolism. It would be impossible to exclusively love his wife like Christ does the church. And it would be impossible to fully give his body to either wife as required in 1 Corinthians 7. Now notice the contrast between the Old Testament and New Testament definition of adultery. In the Old Testament, a man committed adultery by taking somebody else's wife. And the woman committed adultery, it was only by a married woman having relationships with a man, not her husband. But what did not count as adultery? Starting polygamy, continuing polygamy, having concubines, looking for a single woman and lusting after her, affairs with single girls, and remarriage after divorce. Now notice, in Proverbs, there are statements against being ensnared by a married woman. But the focus is not on desire in contrast to the New Testament. See, the New Testament says if you look on lust, you've got adultery in your heart. But the focus in Proverbs is not on desire, but on the foolishness of getting ensnared by her. And again, the Old Testament is focusing on the relationship with a married woman. So you see, the New Testament definition is broader and the same for men and women. Remarriage after divorce, extramarital affairs, looking and lusting, and cannot start a polygamous relationship. Now, consistency will prohibit any polygamy in the New Testament era. Why? Well, the consistency of the Old Testament, men were permitted to have multiple women in various situations, including remarriage after divorce, polygamy, concubines, and so on. The Old Testament is consistent with itself. You can have contemporaneous polygamy, that means several wives at once, or you could have serial polygamy, like is done in America, where you have one, divorce her, have another, divorce her, have another, divorce her. That was permitted in the Old Testament. But the consistency in the New Testament, Jesus clearly prohibits multiple wives in divorce remarriage cases. This self-consistency in the Old Testament has changed because contrary to the Old Testament, you cannot have divorce remarriage in the New Testament. Now, consistent with this no remarriage command of Christ would not allow multiple marriage even if there is no divorce. You see, if it's adultery to divorce your wife and marry someone else, well, it would certainly be adultery to marry someone else without divorcing your wife. So Jesus effectively forbids polygamy. If looking on a woman to lust after her without divorcing your wife is adultery, well then additional marriage without divorcing your wife would also be adultery. Because how could you avoid looking at this second wife that you've got and not desiring her? And if remarriage after divorce is adultery, then certainly remarriage without divorce would be adultery. Now the ultimate answer is this. In the New Testament, remarriage is not permitted, not because of divorce, but because a man is already married. Any polygamous union is adultery because for wife number two, the man is already married. Now let me talk a little bit about the importance of consistency. There are two important uses of consistency. One is, oh, we're doing something and we realize, you know, here's something else that we're doing, and we're not being consistent with a principle, so we change what we're doing to make it consistent with the principle we say we believe. That is what is commonly called consistency. And you hear that over and over. Unfortunately, there is another use of consistency, one which is probably even more important and is almost totally neglected in many circles. And that is, a lack of consistency reveals a false theorem, a false theory, a false doctrine. If you have something that's inconsistent, it may be that the proposition you're trying to follow is false. And you should say, oh, I see. The doctrine I thought was so important is actually false. Now, let me give you an illustration from mathematics. There are some things in mathematics that you can prove directly. You say, I have this fact, that leads me to this fact, that leads me to this fact. Therefore, if I have the first fact, I have the conclusion. For example, if you have an isosceles triangle, that means a triangle with two sides the same length. You can prove from that that the bottom angles of that triangle are equal. You start with certain facts, and then as you go through those facts, you can prove fact one, fact two, fact three, and then get to the conclusion at the end. That's called a direct proof. But there are many things in mathematics that are true, but very difficult to prove that way. And you prove them by indirect proof. And let me show you a very simple one. How many of you have ever heard or been taught in school that you may, if you're doing algebra, you may not divide by zero? Did you ever hear of that? Anybody? Okay, maybe one person or so. Well, let me tell you, it's true. You may not divide by zero. If you're doing an algebra problem and you divide by zero, you will get nonsense out of your answer. And you know, a person might wonder, well, why can't I divide by zero? I can divide by all the other numbers. Why not by zero? What if you wanted to prove that it's wrong to divide by zero? If you were trying to prove that directly, it would be a difficult proof. But proving it by seeing a contradiction is easy. Because the way you do an indirect proof is you say, well, assume a certain thing is true. And then you start proceeding down the line as if it were true. And when you get to a contradiction that you know can't happen, you say, how did I ever get here? How did I get this contradiction? Oh, I know. I assume this thing is true. Therefore, it must be false. So let's just try it here. We'll do an easy proof. Let's assume you could divide by zero. Shall we? Ready?
Well, first of all, 8 times 0 equals 3 times 0. Is that a correct statement? What is 8 times 0? 0. And 3 times 0 is 0.
So this is a true statement, right? Okay. Now, let's divide by 0. What do we get? 8 equals 3. Is that a true statement? No, that's a false statement. How did I ever get to such a dumb answer as this? What's the answer? How did I get here? I did this unpermitted thing. I divided by zero. See right there? I've just proved that you cannot divide by zero. So you can remember that the rest of your life. If any of your algebra students try to divide by zero, say, no, no, I learned that long ago. And you see, here's how we solve that problem. Inconsistency, 8 equals 3. That inconsistency shows something is wrong here. We did something wrong. That shows dividing by zero is a no-no. Now, that is also true in Scripture. Jesus proved the resurrection by pointing out inconsistency of no resurrection. Remember how the Sadducees told him this story about the woman who had 7 different husbands in a row because each one married she married all these brothers after the first ones died. And Jesus said, have you not read at Moses in the bush, God said, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God is not a God of the dead, but of the living. Now, Jesus is trying to prove the resurrection by quoting Scripture. Would you have thought of using that verse to prove that? I would have never thought of it. How is his proof working? Well, assume there is no resurrection. See, that's what the Sadducees wanted to believe. Assume there's no resurrection. Now you read this verse, God says, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, and it's something he said to Moses. What's the problem? That's right. Those guys are dead. They've been dead for hundreds of years. And he says to Moses, I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, which means for that to be true, there has to be a resurrection. See, he's proving it by having the contradiction that arises out of the Sadducees' false belief. Okay, so just remember that. Consistency sometimes shows you aren't applying a principle properly. I mean, inconsistency. Lack of consistency sometimes shows you aren't applying a principle properly. But sometimes a lack of consistency shows you that your principle is false. See, when I took the principle that I could divide by zero, I got into an inconsistency, which showed, you can't divide by zero after all. And the consistency in the Old Testament and in the New Testament fits with God's character. He is not a God of confusion. You see, in the Old Testament, God allowed multiple partners for men. It was not accounted as adultery as long as you weren't taking somebody else's wife. In the New Testament, Jesus slams the door on that and says, if you divorce your wife and marry someone else, you are committing adultery. And then that has implications on what all is connected with that, because that's not just a statement by itself. It's connected to other things that relate to marriage as well. In time past, God overlooked some things, but now commands all men everywhere to repent. Acts 17, verse 30. So, in dealing with polygamy, we have to recognize errors that are associated with allowing existing polygamy. If you allow existing polygamy to come into the church, it will bring you into conflict with the New Testament. Well, what should be done with a polygamist who has three wives and one of them is a divorcee? Now, according to the New Testament, he can't be married to a divorcee, right? So you see where you're getting into a problem. If you appeal to the Old Testament, you're going to have to allow him to continue with the divorcee. But that'll make you inconsistent with the New Testament. And by the way, simply because there is divorce in polygamous cultures, there will be divorcees among polygamists. I remember when this was a big controversy. And so, when I had an opportunity, I checked with one of the missionaries when he was home about this. I said, there are polygamists in your church that have divorcee wives, aren't there? He said, yes. Because you see, if you allow polygamists, the standard procedure in a polygamous society is one man divorces a woman and another guy will pick her up. And so that's consistent with the Old Testament. The Old Testament allows divorce and remarriage and polygamy, but we are not in the Old Testament era. Some people have argued, well, some of these peoples, they live like an Old Testament culture. That doesn't prove one thing. There is nobody on earth today that is in the Old Testament era. It might have similarities to Old Testament culture. They might be able to understand the Old Testament culture more easily than you do. For example, among the Fulani, the nomadic cattle herders in Nigeria, they loved the sections where it said, you know, the wilderness wanderings, they went to such and such a place and they camped there several days and they moved their herds to another place and they camped there several days. Why do you think they like that so much? Because their lifestyle is moving their herds from one place to another and they're concerned about finding water for them and all that. So you see, they could identify with that part of the Old Testament probably better than we do. It is impossible to require the divorced, remarried person to separate while allowing the polygamous partners to remain together. You cannot say, well, sir, since you have these all at one time, you can have them all. And sir, over here, since you're having them sequentially, you can just stay with the one you've got. Well, you can't stay with the one you've got because you have no right to it according to Jesus. You see, allowing existing polygamy demands allowing existing remarriage. And what this will do, it'll produce two classes in the church. Those who can have multiple wives and those who cannot. I believe that a man who is a polygamist will need to separate from any adulterous relationships the same as someone in American culture. And notice, in the book of Ezra, when he had to deal with wrong marriages, there had to be immediate actions. It's not an endless dilly-dally. We looked at that the other evening. I believe that a polygamist should remain with his first legitimate wife. And the reason I say it that way is because it's possible that the first wife that a polygamist took was a divorcee that someone else dropped off. So that would be an invalid marriage according to the New Testament. And then maybe he picks up a new wife that had never been married, and his second wife would be his first legitimate wife. Or shall we say it this way, his only legitimate wife. But so we clarify the situation, we say first, just so people understand. And if he had a legitimate first wife that he had divorced, he could not remain with any of his subsequent wives because of consistency regarding what remarriage after divorce involves. Furthermore, I believe that he should support all his wives and teach all his children. And the church would need to take some active steps to help in some of the complications of that situation. By the way, in America, there are times where a man departs from an adulterous marriage, and then the church takes up some slack in helping with babysitting and various kind of things that go on. According to 1 Timothy 3, verse 2, such a man would not be eligible for church leadership. We discussed that earlier. He would not be a one-woman man regarding entanglements. Well, what about the example of the man who had a leveret marriage and then a sweetheart marriage? What should be done then? You know, if we would take the case in the opposite order, we would say we know the answer, wouldn't we? You see what that's doing? It's letting our emotions be the determinant instead of the facts. In other words, the first woman you're married to is the one you're married to in the New Testament era. And if you marry another one, that is not permitted. I know of one polygamous culture where there were two types of marriage. Just imagine this kind of situation. See, some people advocate that when you have work, mission work in a polygamous culture, then somebody that has three wives already and he gets converted, well, that's how he came, so he comes that way and he stays that way in the church. Now you see, that's exactly analogous to a man who's divorced and remarried before he gets converted. Is he going to stay with his second wife, which Jesus says is adultery? But just imagine this. In this culture, there's one kind of wedding called kubgal. And it's a wedding arranged by the parents in the proper way with the normal exchange of bride price. It has the sanction of the community. The bride and groom are free from prior marriages. But then there's another kind of marriage, tigal. It's the practice of wife stealing. You go to a clan gathering and flirt with the women and convince one of them to abandon her husband and to run off with you. Well, naturally, the husband doesn't like this, so there's likely to be a sword fight. But being the macho guy you are, you win, and thus you gain popular admiration. In fact, being a real man is measured in part by how many tigals you have accomplished. Now, in this culture, would you allow a man to continue with wives he had stolen? You see, the culture says that's legitimate. Similarly, the culture says that taking multiple virgins or people that have not been married is legitimate. You can see that there's just one thing after another that contradicts with the New Testament. John Patton, who was a missionary to the South Sea Islands, he saw clearly the impossibility of allowing one to come into the church with two wives while not allowing a member to take two wives. You see, you can't have two classes of people. One man who has two wives and one man who can only have one. Well, there's going to be objections. People will object to this. Somebody's going to say, well, but in 2 Samuel 12, God speaks of giving David's master's wives into his bosom. If polygamy was adultery, God would be condoning adultery. Well, first of all, the wives of a deceased king were entrusted to the custody of his successor. That was the practice of the day. And if such widows were to marry another, any descendant would be a threat to the throne. And that explains why Solomon was so alarmed at Adonijah that wanted Abishag. But remember, the real deal is that polygamy was not counted as adultery in the Old Testament, so it doesn't address the question of whether polygamy is adultery in the New Testament. And we can also refute that idea by context. 2 Samuel 12, 11. God says, I'm giving David's wives to his neighbor. Well, the fact that God gave David's wives to his neighbor, does that prove that God approves of wife swapping? No, it doesn't. Somebody else is going to say, well, in polygamy, a man becomes one with his first wife, and then this oneness also becomes one with the second wife. You know, it's interesting that there's a difference in wording in the New Testament regarding a man and wife becoming one and in the Old Testament. In the Old Testament, it says this, Genesis 2:24, a man shall leave father and mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Now, God created a pair in Eden. He did not create multiple women for Adam. Only the two were joined. Man later perverted marriage, and the Old Testament allowed for a man having multiple women. But in the New Testament, when both Jesus and Paul quote this, they insert an extra note in the quote. In the New Testament, they put in, the two shall become one flesh. Matthew 19, verse 5, and Ephesians 5:31. And especially in Mark chapter 10, verse 8, the emphasis is on moving from two to one. It says this, quote, and the two shall become one flesh, so they are no longer two, but one flesh. You notice how that door is slammed shut by the wording in the New Testament. In other words, the New Testament explicitly emphasizes two becoming one in contrast to the Old Testament. Well, why did God allow polygamy and divorce and remarriage in the Old Testament and not now? Acts 17:30 answers that question. It was a time of ignorance. But now he requires everybody to repent. You see, this relates to the Old Testament regulations regarding divorce. God restricted evil behavior. It doesn't mean that evil behavior was right. Restricting some of the damage it could do. Somebody else is going to say, well, the New Testament is silent regarding polygamy. The New Testament speaks about adultery, but it doesn't say a word about polygamy. Matthew 5:32. But remember, in Matthew 5:32, Jesus does not condemn a divorce as adultery, but says the man is culpable for the wife's adultery. In Jesus' day, polygamy apparently was not a major issue. And so Jesus was not addressing it. At least, it's very difficult to find material that would say there were many polygamists in Jesus' day. Polygamy was acknowledged and regulated in Old Testament law, but there is no practice of it after the captivity on record in the Old Testament. In other words, after the captivity, you have no record of polygamy mentioned in the Old Testament. And in Christ's time, a monogamous marriage was the rule among Greeks and Romans and Jews. Now, polygamy as practiced in the Old Testament, it was by the patriarchs and by judges during Israel's decadent period known as the period of the judges, and by kings. Apparently, it was somewhat unusual for an ordinary Israelite. And it's interesting that the content of Proverbs is notably silent regarding polygamy. It talks about the unhappiness of a wretched marriage and a wife that's a continual contention. And it talks about it's wonderful to have a good wife and terrible to have one that's bad. And how that the husband and wife are to work together in training the children. But it doesn't discuss polygamy. There's someone who has said that there was evidence for polygamy in Jesus' day. 10% in one town. I don't really know how well to vouch for that claim. Anyway, the argument from silence, the New Testament silence on polygamy is not conclusive. You have to be very careful about taking an argument from silence and say that proves something. Because Jesus did not address concubines in the New Testament either. Does that mean that a man could have concubines today? And similarly, how many of you men who are preachers did you ever in your lifetime explicitly preach against polygamy? So should we claim then that you evidently okay polygamy since you didn't preach against it? You see, people gravitate to weak arguments because they don't have good ones. Just remember that when people give you that argument from silence. Argument from silence proves very little unless it's a silence where he talks about this one thing and it's in the context in such a way that it is thunderingly silent, if you want to put it in those terms. Well, when Peter preached in Acts 2, some will say, he did not question them about polygamy. How do you know? Like Kim Ham says, were you there? I mean, maybe polygamy wasn't an issue with the crowd he was dealing with. You see, it's that argument from silence again. Besides, the record of what he spoke is actually incomplete. We don't know what all he said. Because after a detailed additional exhortation, those who received the word were baptized, Acts 2:40. It says more things were said than what's recorded. Well, somebody's going to say, on an issue as important as polygamy, since the New Testament does not explicitly address it, should we not also be silent? Well, murder was forbidden in the Ten Commandments. Thou shalt not murder. But military application of deadly force was commanded of believers in the Old Testament. You can read about it in various places. However, how do we know that it's wrong in the New Testament for believers to use deadly force in a military situation? How do we know that? Is there any explicit statement in the New Testament that says such a thing?
Love your enemies
is going to say it by implication. Okay? I'm not disputing that. I'm saying, is there any explicit statement in the New Testament that says a believer is not to participate in the military using deadly force to kill somebody? Is there any such statement? Okay. That one, I'll just say this. That was John the Baptist. He was still in the Old Testament era, okay? So I don't want to discuss what it means right now, but the point I'm making is, for a command to have that the Christian does not use deadly force in a military situation in the New Testament, it is by implication regarding what was said here, love your enemies. Now you have to be careful with that one, because in the Old Testament it says love your enemies too, okay? So there's probably some other verses that we would use even more. Deal gently with all men. It's pretty hard to be gentle in how you kill somebody. Anyway, what I'm saying is the New Testament has plenty of things in it when Jesus says turn the other cheek and you know, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, and so on. There are plenty of things that by implication would put the N-O beside the idea of using deadly force for the Christian New Testament. And similarly, what Jesus says regarding divorce and remarriage implies that it would not be right to continue in polygamy. You see, if you refuse to embrace the implications of the New Testament, it will produce moral rot. It'll produce moral rot in individuals and in leadership and in your children. Some people argue regarding the mission field. It says things like this. Well, if we want to allow for polygamy in incoming believers, lest we inadvertently create a works religion. That's one of the arguments that's used. You see, we don't want to create a works religion, so we allow incoming believers to have their polygamous wives. Well, would you say Jesus was wrong in making explicit works demands on the rich young ruler? He wanted to know how to have eternal life, and Jesus said, do this, do this, do this. Don't do that. He said, he gave specific commandments. Somebody's going to say that separation of polygamous unions involves so many practical and social difficulties that the losses are greater than the gains. It's the wrong approach to life. The issue is whether the union is adulterous. It is not whether there's difficulties associated with it. But if the fact is this, the union is adulterous, and the losses involved in staying together will always be greater than the gains, percolating into many areas and corrupting many people. In fact, it's interesting when you look at how Noah was commanded to take animals into the ark. He took two of each kind, even the unclean ones. And he took of the clean ones more pairs. In other words, there were pairs that went into the ark, both for clean and unclean. You see, there's the same standard for both. It's just an interesting analogy. See, some people think that for practical reasons, we cannot do what the scriptures imply. Actually, for practical reasons, we cannot afford to miss doing what the scriptures imply. Somebody's going to say, well, this approach in a Muslim culture will force the dismissed wives into prostitution. You know, the same argument could be used to apply even more against, more than ever, against presenting even the gospel to a Muslim woman whose husband is a staunch Muslim, and he will beat her up and throw her out. We have to have the gospel speak for itself. And a believing husband who dismisses his wife out of obedience to Christ but still provides for her definitely does not force her into prostitution. See, many times people will take an argument that's full of emotion and say, well, you know, if this man dismisses his wives, well, then she's forced into prostitution. She has no way to make a livelihood. You know, he can still provide for her. He's providing for her now. He can still provide for her, but not live with her as a wife. And besides, if there's another Christian in the area, and obviously there would be because there's at least one missionary there, if you're talking about doing mission work, such a wife is not forced into prostitution because the church is obligated by Christ to care for the destitute. And so there would be reason for the missionary to pick up some of that slack. And the church would help such a person to make a decent living. Somebody might say this, if we use this approach in missions, we will offend many people. We've got to make a clear distinction between us offending somebody because we were obnoxious and Christ offending someone. You know, there are many things in the American culture that are very offensive to non-Christians. I mean, sorry. There are many things in the gospel that are very offensive to non-Christians of American culture. My wife, for example, wears a covering, and she's walking through the Walmart store, and some woman says, excuse me, what is that on your head? Why are you wearing that? And so she begins to describe 1 Corinthians 11 and how it's a sign of her agreement with God's headship order, where a wife submits to her husband. I mean, some people don't like to hear that. It's offensive to them. You see, we've got to make a distinction between us doing something personally offensive and the gospel not being liked by those who hear. One of the reasons that many missions allow for existing polygamy in Africa is that they allow existing serial polygamy in North America. Do you understand what I mean by serial polygamy? Marry a woman, divorce her, marry someone else, divorce her, marry someone else, divorce her, and go on. That's in essence serial polygamy, whereas a man who has three wives all at one time would be contemporaneous polygamy. Somebody says this, well, polygamy is an African problem. The new believers in Africa should decide. You know what? It is not just an African problem. A converted Mormon could retain multiple wives in that case. Would you receive an African brother here in this fellowship with multiple wives? You see, aberrant marriage, marriage that's not according to God's standard, is a global problem. And polygamy is an example of aberrant marriage, whether it's in Utah or Toronto or Africa. And by the way, the push for legalized homosexual marriage will help usher in legalized polygamy and polyandry or polyamory, in other words, group marriage in America. Adultery is not defined by geography. Missionaries are to teach all things Christ commanded, whether explicitly or by implication. Now, when I say by implication, I don't mean somebody's just making an inference, thinking this would be a good idea. I mean like that triangle where you have two sides that are equal. It demands those angles are equal. That's implication. It's refuted by the example of the Apostle Paul, by the way, because in 1 Corinthians 11, apparently the Christian woman's covering was commonly practiced in churches, and yet Paul did not leave just new believers in Corinth to decide, but wrote an explicit and detailed instruction and insisted on obedience. Well, what if a church has no men who qualify for leadership because of these marriage tangles? Well, it's very clear that there are some churches in the New Testament that were existing and functioning without elders. How do we know? Because Paul commanded Titus to appoint elders in those cities. He wasn't going to appoint elders if there was no fellowship there. You don't just appoint elders by himself. And so if you have no men that are qualified in a congregation, then you better get busy and start qualifying some. Maybe you can appoint some people to be temporary administrators, and so they don't have the status as elders. They just have to temporarily administrate some things while you get busy and qualify somebody in terms of their study of the Scriptures, in terms of their private and public life, so that they meet the qualifications. So what do we conclude? When we consider the whole picture of marriage in the Bible, we need to understand marriage first of all. You don't begin by divorce. You don't begin by looking at polygamy, but you begin by what God's standard for marriage is. Then you realize what some of these deviations have been, and you see what the New Testament has to say about those deviations. And then in your own marriage, in a God-joined marriage, value it and build it. And then study these things so that you can give a clear answer to anyone who asks.